Now, as I say, the section we're going to study, maybe that's an overstatement, scan might be a fairer word tonight, goes from 13 right through to 22. But I want to read just one section from chapter 14 to give you a flavour for what's going on in these chapters. It's headed in the NIV, Hebron given to Caleb, and begins at verse 6 of chapter 14. So let's hear God's word together. Now the men of Judah approached Joshua at Gilgal, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, "You know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, at Kadesh Barnea, about you and me. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to explore the land, and I brought him back a report according to my convictions. But my brothers who went up with me made the hearts of the people melt with fear. I, however, followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly. So on that day Moses swore to me, 'The land on which your feet have walked will be your inheritance, and that of your children forever, because you have followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly.' Now then, just as the Lord promised, he has kept me alive for 45 years since the time he said this to Moses, while Israel moved about in the desert. So here I am today, 85 years old. I'm still as strong today as the day Moses sent me out. I'm just as vigorous to go out to battle now as I was then. Now give me this hill country that the Lord promised me that day. You yourself heard then that the Anakites were there, and their cities were large and fortified. But the Lord helping me, I will drive them out, just as he said." And then Joshua blessed Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and gave him Hebron as his inheritance. So Hebron has belonged to Caleb, son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, ever since, because he followed the Lord God of Israel wholeheartedly. There is a very deep yearning in every human soul, isn't there, for a home. Speaking as one who is away from home too much and has been away from home these last couple of weeks, I can tell you that from personal experience. No matter how many times you've been away before, no matter how much you enjoyed the trip, there is a strange surge of reassurance every time the plane begins to descend on those green fields of England once again. And any of you who've come back from being abroad will know what I mean about that. No doubt the Victorian composer J.H. Payne did overdo the saccharine a bit in his famous song, Home Sweet Home. But the sentiment of its chorus is not really inaccurate. "Mid pleasures and palaces, though we may roam, be it ever so humble, there's no place like home." And that's, I guess, why Steven Spielberg in his film E.T. touched such a resonant chord in our hearts when that quirky alien from outer space pointed his spindly finger at the sky and pleaded, "E.T. phone home." One way or another, we all, like E.T., share that longing to connect with a place where we belong. A place where our loneliness will be dispelled. A place of security and emotional satisfaction. A place, in other words, called home. As that other sugary Victorian cliche puts it, home is where the heart is. The trouble is, of course, much as we all empathise with such sentiments, the experience of home is actually an elusive one. For many of us here, perhaps, the very word home is tinged with a certain ambiguity, even a certain pain. We come from broken homes. And even for those of us who don't, there is still an elusiveness about this search for a sense of home. You could make a good biblical case, I think, for saying that homelessness is an inescapable part of our human condition. Ever since Adam and Eve were banished from the Garden of Eden, we have, in a sense, been homeless. We've been searching for some solution to a congenital state of lostness. The book of Genesis tells us that Cain, Adam and Eve's eldest son, built a city and raised a family. But he still felt himself to be a restless wanderer on the earth, to use his words. And don't we all, in a way, we catch the occasional nostalgic glimpse of that Edenic paradise, that home that we forfeited long ago. But the experience always seems to slip through our fingers. No matter how warm our family circle, no matter how strong our local community, no matter how intense our patriotic sentiments, in short, no matter how idyllic our social environment may be, nothing quite repairs that inner feeling of alienation in the permanent and satisfying way for which we really deep down yearn. In that sense, all of us come from broken homes. Now, it's important to realize that the story of the people of God in the Bible is the story of a journey home. It begins when Abraham leaves prosperous urban life in Ur of the Chaldees to become a nomad of the desert. And all on the strength of a promise. God said to Abraham that he had a special homeland in view for him and for his descendants. But if Abraham was to find that homeland, he would have to sever his roots in pagan Mesopotamia and strike out alone into uncharted territory. Now, the quest for that promised land, as it comes to be called, thereafter becomes a central theme of the biblical narrative. It's a dream towards which the people of God are forever moving, it seems, though without ever quite arriving. For them too, home is
elusive.
Abraham himself, for instance, actually lives in the promised land, but the only piece of it he actually comes to own is his wife's grave. His grandson Jacob also lives there in the promised land for a while with his 12 sons, but in his old age he's forced by famine to leave the land, and for the next few centuries the Israelites have to live in Egypt instead, miles away from the promised land. With the arrival of Moses, the quest for the promised land revives. But once again, things never quite work out. They leave Egypt, but only to wander for 40 years in the wilderness. And even when they eventually do take possession of the promised land under Joshua, as we've been seeing in our series of studies in this book, their occupation of it is still insecure, still incomplete. Only for a very brief window of time, during the monarchies of David and Solomon, does the land at last seem to be fully theirs. But once again, the dream proves elusive. It slips through their fingers. First there's territorial schism due to a civil war, then there's invasion and conquest by enemy forces, and finally, the cream of the Israelite population is banished into exile, and the land is lost altogether. And yet still that thought, that quest, that dream of a promised homeland goes on haunting their minds. In fact, even now, of course, millennia later, that dream lives on as the influence of Zionism in the Middle East so eloquently proves. Now, the political explanation for this fragility in Israel's tenure of the promised land, the land of Palestine, isn't difficult to trace. Throughout her history, she has again and again been the unfortunate victim of militaristic empires much more powerful than herself. Assyria, Babylon, Greece, and Rome, they all conquered her by turns in the Old Testament period. But according to the Bible, and it's important to understand this, that political victimization which Israel suffered is not the real reason for her failure to possess the homeland of her dreams. Now, the Bible insists that running through the history of Israel, there is a crucially important subtext. A subtext written by God himself. Israel's search for a homeland, you see, is a kind of divinely ordered metaphor. It's a picture of our human quest more generally for that paradise we lost in the infancy of our race. The real home for which Israel is searching is actually the one we're looking for too. And according to the Bible, the fulfillment of that dream does not lie in some territorial acquisition in the Middle East. It ultimately lies in a whole new world which God intends one day to create. A world in which all the brokenness and the alienations of this present world will be forever banished. A world, as that book of Revelation we were reading from earlier puts it, a world in which God will wipe every tear from our eyes. A world in which, at last, we will feel permanently and fully at home. Now, if you're going to rightly understand the story the Bible is telling us, a story, as I say, of a journey home, then it's absolutely vital you penetrate this underlying layer of metaphor, of symbolism, of typology, as it's technically called. You have to read the Bible story through the lens of this deeper metaphorical significance it contains. If you're really to understand what it means for you and me today, I've just put a key passage from the New Testament on the overhead to illustrate the point. If you were here for the very first study in this series, back in April, you'll remember I mentioned this passage then, but many of you students were still on back then, so I thought it was important to draw your attention to it afresh. This comes from the book of Hebrews, a book which is very interested in the way in which the Old Testament story is fulfilled in the experience of the Christian today. And this is how Hebrews comments on Abraham and his search for a home. Just look at it. Abraham made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He was looking forward to a city with foundations, whose builder and maker is God. From this one man came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. They admitted that they were aliens and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. They're longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. See what the writer there is saying? Abraham is looking for a home. But it's not really the promised land. He did live in the promised land for a while, but he never really felt at home there. Neither did any other of the Jews when they lived in the promised land. They always confessed that they were really aliens and strangers on the earth. For the real home they were looking for is one which transcends this planet, this present world. They are looking for a better country, a heavenly country. Now, it's against this background, you see, that you have to interpret our study passage in the book of Joshua this evening. There are many passages in the Old Testament which you can study adequately without perhaps fully grasping that kind of typological significance that lies behind Old Testament history. But when you read these central chapters of the book of Joshua, you really can't get anything out of it at all unless you read it through this lens I'm talking about. If you looked at superficially, you could be forgiven for thinking that this is an exceptionally tedious section of the Bible. Just cast your eye through it, 13 to 22 chapters in Joshua, and you'll find large parts of it are taken up with defining the geographical boundaries of the 12 tribes of ancient Israel. Well, interesting information perhaps for the archaeologist, and important, no doubt, to the ancient Israelites themselves, who would depend upon such a record for the settlement of their territorial disputes. But what possible relevance could such cartographic details have for you and me today? The answer, I say, lies in an appreciation of this typological significance which underlies the book of Joshua. Drawing maps of ancient Palestine may be of little interest to us, but going to heaven ought to be of interest to us. And in the strange providence of God, you see, the former is actually a picture of the latter. That's why when you read the New Testament, you find, for instance, the Apostle Peter speaking of heaven as the Christian's inheritance. That word occurs several times in the New Testament. Heaven is the Christian's inheritance. And that's a word lifted straight out of these chapters in Joshua. It originally applied to the promised land. But for Christians, the promised land is heaven. That's their inheritance. The Apostle Paul similarly speaks of Christians as heirs of Abraham's promise. In other words, the homeland for which Abraham and his descendants longed is identified in the New Testament as the spiritual dream home for which every son and daughter of Adam yearns. And it is that dream home which has been pledged to us afresh by a second Joshua. Of course, we usually know him by the Greek rather than the Hebrew version of his name, not as Joshua, but as Jesus. But it's far from insignificant that the two names are actually the same. How did Jesus himself put it in that famous Sermon on the Mount? The meek shall inherit the earth. Except, of course, that sentence could just as properly be translated, you know, the meek shall inherit the land. And almost certainly that's how the first Jews heard him when he said it in Aramaic. The meek shall inherit the land. That's what Jesus came to do. He came to bring the long exile of the people of God to an end. He came to fulfill the spiritual, heavenly reality of which the physical territory of Palestine was merely a metaphor, a symbol, an educational aid. He came, in other words, to give us the homeland we human beings yearn for. So in our study tonight, I want us to apply this New Testament typological grid to these rather unpromising central chapters of the book of Joshua. For in telling us about Israel's conquest of her homeland in Canaan, God is not merely informing our antiquarian curiosity about what things were like 1200 years BC, he's teaching us lessons about our personal journey to heaven. In fact, I would suggest he's warning us in these chapters of two critical blunders we can make on that journey if we're not very careful. Two things which were clearly potential dangers to the Israelites as they took possession of the physical promised land, and which it seems to me, interpreted through this New Testament lens I'm talking about, are also perilous to Christians as they seek to take possession of their heavenly inheritance in Christ. Those two perils, those two blunders, are laziness and greed. Nothing else, I hope, looking at these two chapters, what they have to teach us about those two things, will prove to us that unpromising texts about geographical specifications can have value for us today in the Bible if they're studied properly. Let's start with laziness. And the text that I have in mind here within our section is 18, verse 3. Chapter 18, verse 3. So Joshua said to the Israelites, "How long will you wait before you begin to take possession of the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you?" One of the things you will notice if you have the patience to read these chapters through is that there is a tension in them. There's a tension, in fact, in the whole book of Joshua between the land, the promised land, as a gift to be received, and the promised land as a task to be achieved. A gift to be received, a task to be achieved. There's a tension between these two perspectives on the land. If you were following this series right from the beginning, you'll maybe be aware of the emphasis in the earlier chapters on the gracious initiative of God, of which Israel was the beneficiary in this whole business of entering the promised land. The opening verses of the very first chapter of Joshua constantly speak of God giving the land to his people as he promised. And as I said, throughout these central chapters, that thought is reinforced by the repeated use of this word inheritance, which you'll find coming up again and again and again and again. Now, an inheritance, of course, is not something you earn by your own efforts. An inheritance is something you receive by virtue of your special relationship to somebody else. an inheritance is always a gift. So the logic of these chapters is that the promised land belongs to God, is really his, but that he has graciously bequeathed it as an inheritance to his people, a bit like a generous parent setting up a beloved child in their own home. Having said that, though, there are also constant warnings running through these chapters against the perils of complacency. For instance, if you look back at the beginning of our section, to chapter 13, verse 1, you'll find right at the beginning of it, there's this mild rebuke directed at Joshua himself in this connection. You are very old, the Lord tells Joshua. Well, I suppose the Lord's allowed to say things like that to people, even if we're not. You are very old. And there are still very large areas of land to be taken over. In other words, don't rest on your laurels, Joshua. It's far too early for you to retire yet, you know. There are more battles to be fought. And frankly, Israel is not proving keen enough to fight those battles. So as you look down the chapters, again and again you'll find reference to the failures of Israel to properly subdue the land as God had told them to do. 13 verse 13. They did not drive out the people of Geshur. 15:63. Judah could not dislodge the Jebusites living in Jerusalem. 16:10. They did not dislodge the Canaanites living in Geza. 17:12. Yet the tribe of Manasseh were not able to occupy these towns. Till finally, we find in chapter 18, verse 3, that text I read at the beginning, Joshua calling the entire community together at Shiloh and publicly challenging them on this unsatisfactory record. How long do you intend to dilly-dally around before you take possession of the land that the Lord your God of your fathers has given you, he says. Do you see then the tension I'm speaking of? It's there in that single verse in 18, verse 3. The land, he says, has been given to you by God. But that gift is not placed in your quiescent laps while you sleep, like Santa Claus filling a child's stocking on Christmas night. No, says Joshua, you have to take possession of this gift by active effort. For the land is not just a gift, it is a task. If you read on chapter 18, the rest of the chapter, you'll see how Joshua seeks to motivate the people to do just that, by ordering a survey of all the land that remains to be conquered, which he then proceeds to allocate by lot to the seven tribes, which up to this point in the narrative had no territory of their own. Well, what I want to suggest to you is that this is all a classic illustration of a spiritual principle, which we find echoed in the New Testament. It's a good example of the way this book of Joshua works typologically for a Christian reader. You see, the land is not earned, it is a graciously bestowed inheritance. But that land must nevertheless be owned by faith and possessed by effort. There's a tension between these things. And in exactly the same way, the New Testament insists that for us, simply because heaven is a gift, it does not follow we have any excuse for lazy complacency in our journey to arrive there. On the contrary, the fact that God has given us eternal life, the New Testament insists, should be an incentive to faith and obedience on our part, not an excuse for laziness. The New Testament writers often argue this point, using this part of the Old Testament narrative to make their point. For instance, Paul argues in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, if you're really keen you can look it up, but if not I'll tell you what it's about. In 1 Corinthians 10, Paul reminds his readers how some of the Jews perished. They never made it to the promised land. They didn't sustain their commitment to God, the commitment they had had when they left Egypt. And having reminded the Jews of this salutary fact, he says, these things happened to them as examples. They were written down as warnings for us, on whom the fulfillment of the ages has come. So, he says, if you think you are standing firm, be careful. Be careful that you don't fall. Beware of complacency. The lesson of Old Testament Israel at this period in her history is beware of complacency. The writer to the Hebrews draws exactly the same lesson from this part of the Old Testament story too, in chapters 3 and 4 of his letter, the letter to the Hebrews. He observes, as well as Paul, the sorry end of the Jews who never made it, who failed, as he puts it, to enter the rest that God had provided for them. And then he too makes this searching comparison to his contemporary Christian readers. Therefore, he says, since the promise of entering his rest, that is the promised land, still stands, let us be careful that none of you be found to have fallen short of it. Let us, he says, make every effort to enter that rest, so that no one will fall by following their example of disobedience. You get the point then? There is this tension between the land as a gift and the land as a task. And it finds a New Testament correspondence in the tension between grace and works. When Joshua rebukes the Israelites for failing to put effort into the fight against the enemies of God, he is rebuking us too for our neglect of a struggle against sin in our lives. If we're going to find that home in heaven that God intends us to find, then we must be willing to work at it. We must be willing to fight for it. Now, this is a truth not all Christians seem readily to accept or embrace. There was a song that was popular in the 1960s. Mercifully, it's dropped out of all the hymn books. But it was very popular. It was sung by a very attractive Christian female singer and hit the sort of Christian top 10 and was sung by everybody for an awful long time, unfortunately. And the words were just appalling. They went like this. If I tried to live for you, Lord, today, if I tried to follow your wonderful way, then all of my life would be me and not you, and none of your glory would ever shine through. Have you ever heard such twaddle as that? See, it's got this idea in it that to be a real believer, to have faith, you have to be passive. You mustn't try. Trying takes the glory from Jesus. You mustn't try, you must just trust. Well, it simply isn't what the Bible says. It simply doesn't wrestle with this tension we're talking about. The logic of the Bible always is this. Try because you trust. Not don't try, trust instead. But try because you trust. Faith is always an active principle. Never a passive lying on my bed waiting for holiness to zap me. I mean, if you think about it, it's the way God always works with us. I'm dependent on God for my daily food. But does that constitute an excuse for me not working for a living? If some super spiritual farmer were to say, well, I'm not going to sow, and I'm not going to plow, and I'm not going to do any work on the farm this year, I'm just going to trust the Lord for a harvest. Is he to be surprised when no harvest is forthcoming? Has God failed to fulfill his promise? No. He hasn't used the means which God has himself appointed for receiving the promised blessing. In the same way, you see, if we are to find heaven, if we are to tread this path that leads that way, if we are to grow in holiness, if the intimacy of our walk with God is to grow richer as the days go by, we have to invest effort in it. It is the means for obtaining moral effort, spiritual effort, prayer effort. These are the means for achieving the promised blessings that God has for us. That's why, of course, the Bible is full of exhortations like, make every effort to add to your faith virtue. Resist the devil. Fight the good fight of faith. engage in a struggle against sin, run the race that is set before you. They're all words of effort and activities. I say again, when Joshua rebukes the laziness of the Israelites, he rebukes us too. For the journey to heaven is a journey that inevitably will involve us in struggle. Don't be surprised at those struggles. Don't feel that somehow you must be missing some sanctification secret, because you're not trusting enough, otherwise you wouldn't have to struggle so hard. Nonsense! It's precisely because you are motivated inwardly by your faith in Christ that you find the desire to struggle. It's precisely because you believe there is land to be possessed that you fight to possess it. That's the first illustration, then, if you like, of this typological grid that we have to apply to these chapters if we are to discover what their New Testament relevance is for us. A warning, I say, against laziness. But a warning, secondarily, also, against greed. And the text I have in mind here, you'll find in chapter 17. 17, verse 14. The people of Joseph, that's one of the tribes, said to Joshua, "Why have you given us only one allotment and one portion for an inheritance? We are a numerous people, and the Lord has blessed us abundantly." Now, the background to this, of course, is the whole philosophy which you will find underlying these chapters 13 to 22. It is a philosophy of equitable distribution of the land. Every clan in the nation, you will find, as you read these chapters, gets a fair share. A fair share that is as allocated to them by God himself. And it's worth observing as a kind of sidelight on that, that, of course, such a management of the land generated a very different kind of polity to that which prevailed in all the surrounding Canaanite nations. In the Canaanite states, generally speaking, the land belonged to the king. The general populace were no more than serfs. The system that was worked in Canaanite countries was fairly similar to medieval feudalism. The serfs worked the land for the profit of their lord. In Israel, on the other hand, every family possessed its own piece of land. It held the freehold title to that land. If you read Leviticus 25, you'll discover that that land was inalienable. It couldn't be sold, it couldn't be lost. It belonged to that family in perpetuity. The most they could do with it, if they needed to raise money on it, was to lease it out for a maximum of 50 years. But when the Jubilee year came, the 50th year, all land went back to the clan, to the family, to which it was originally allocated in the time of Joshua. That was the theory. And of course, if you think about it, that generated a very remarkable kind of distributive justice. A distributive justice was actually built into the social system. In an agrarian society, the ownership of land represents economic power. By distributing the land in this equitable way, God was making sure that no wealthy elite could monopolize that economic power. In fact, Joshua was coming very close to creating what Margaret Thatcher would have called a property-owning democracy. However, the maintenance of this uniquely just system of distributive justice depended, of course, on the strong tribes not using their military and political muscle to grab more territory for themselves than was rightfully theirs. It required, in other words, that a sense of fraternal fair play should triumph over private greed. There was always going to be the risk that our human propensity for selfishness would subvert the distributive justice of this land distribution. And here in chapter 17, I suggest to you, we see early evidence of that very danger coming to the surface. You see, the tribe of Joseph is a powerful tribe, numerous, strong, and it is not satisfied with the size of its allotted territory. They demand more. Now notice Joshua's unsympathetic response in verse 15. "If you're so numerous," Joshua answered, "and if the hill country of Ephraim is too small for you, go up into the forest and clear land for yourselves there in the land of the Perizzites and the Rephaites." In other words, if you're so big and powerful and you need more space, go and take it from the Canaanite tribes who occupy the forested hill country that hasn't been allocated to anybody else yet. But the tribe of Joseph is still not happy, verse 16. "The people of Joseph replied, 'The hill country is not enough for us, and all the Canaanites who live in the plain have iron chariots.'" In other words, the amount of fertile land immediately available in that hill country was small because most of it was forested. What's more, it would be defended by the Canaanites who occupied the nearby valleys and who were unusually well equipped militarily. They've got iron chariots. But again, Joshua is not impressed and will not be manipulated into taking a softer line. He goes on in verse 17, "You've got plenty of manpower. If there's not enough fertile land in that forested hill country, then cut down some of the trees and generate more cultivatable land for yourself. Put a bit of muscle power in. As for the Canaanites, who will contest your right to that territory, well, you can beat them if you have a mind to do so, iron chariots and all." You see what Joshua is saying, reading a little between the lines here? He's saying, you have military muscle, but you must not use that military muscle to give you superior political leverage in territorial disputes with your brothers. You are to respect the allotted boundaries God has laid down. You are not allowed to call them into question. You are not to use your strength to call them into question. Instead, you are to make the most of the opportunity God has given you. You are to stop casting covetous eyes on what he's given your brothers, and you are to make the most of what he's given you. That's what Joshua is saying. Now, once again, there is a general spiritual principle here, which is echoed in the New Testament. It's applied in the New Testament in a number of areas. It's applied in regard to our material possessions in the world. It's also applied to our spiritual opportunities within the church. We are, the New Testament insists, to demonstrate contentment with our lot. Just as Joshua urges Joseph to exercise contentment with his lot. Two incidents in the life of Jesus come to my mind in this connection. As regards material contentment, I'm reminded of an incident you can read, if you want, in Luke chapter 12. It's a situation in which Jesus almost seems to face the same kind of situation that Joshua is dealing with here. A self-evidently covetous man tries to enlist Jesus' support in a legal battle over money that he's having with his brother. "Teacher," says the man, "tell my brother to divide his inheritance with me." Very similar, really, to what Joseph was saying to Joshua, you see. "I haven't got enough. My brother over there has got some. He doesn't need it all. Tell him to give me some. I've got a raw deal. I want to put pressure on my brother to get more." And just like Joshua, Jesus refuses to take this covetous man's side. Instead, he warns him very solemnly to beware of greed. "A man's life," he says, "does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And then he tells one of those matchless parables of his about a rich idiot who valued his pension fund more than his life. "I've got loads of money. I'm going to have a whale of a time in my retirement," he said, and then died that very night. "What use was his pension fund then?" comments Jesus. "He was a fool." Interestingly, there was one tribe in Israel who you could almost argue were specially commissioned to model contentment in this regard. The Levites. Now, they're mentioned several times in these chapters. Again, if you read through, you'll find a number of references to them. But in every case, the same point is made about them. You see, uniquely, the Levites received no territorial allotment. They were the priestly tribe and did not live, therefore, in one single area of the country. They were told they had to occupy some 48 towns scattered throughout the entire nation so that their priestly ministry was readily available in every locality. That was the point. You can find the actual list of these towns in chapter 21 if you're interested. But it is chapter 13, verse 33, that perhaps sheds the most interesting light on the deeper inner reason for the Levites' landless status. 13:33 says, "To the tribe of Levi, Moses had given no inheritance." Notice, "The Lord, the God of Israel, is their inheritance." Now, in many cultures in the ancient Middle East, the priestly caste were the wealthiest. Indeed, that's true in many cultures today. The priestly caste are the wealthiest because of their privileged position in society. Interestingly, in Israel, once again, it would be different. Her priests would, on the whole, be poorer than their fellows and would depend on the generosity of the rest of the population for much of their material support as a result. But in doing so, you see, it almost seems as if they were to model to their brothers spiritual priorities, the spiritual blessing of God-centered living. The Lord is their inheritance. They haven't got any land. Economically, they're deprived, but spiritually, they're rich. For their special intimacy with God would amply compensate them for their lack of territory. In that way, you could say the Levites were to the wider nation of Israel what the New Testament says the church should be to the wider world. A kind of spiritual witness to the emptiness and the ephemeralness of material things and the great wisdom which it is, therefore, to lay up one's treasures in heaven. If the clans of Joseph had had more sympathy, more spiritual resonance with the Levites, they would not have been found making their greedy demands. They could have learned a bit from the Levites. Sadly, it is an open question whether the world can learn anything on that score from the church. For all too often, I fear, the church simply echoes the avarice of the world as far as material things go. But there's another incident, I said, in the Gospels, which comes to my mind in regard to this whole subject of greed. Not this time materialistic greed, but greed in regard to spiritual prestige within the people of God. The incident I'm thinking of here you'll find in Luke chapter 22, verses 24 to 30. This is a passage you might want to look up. Luke 22, verses 24 to 30. This incident, believe it or not, happens while they're still gathered around the communion table, Jesus and his disciples. A dispute, we're told, arose among them as to which of them was considered to be greatest. Now, do you see the connection there? The tribe of Joseph wanting to exercise its muscle to get more share of the land, to be more prominent, to be more powerful in the community. If you look down at verse 29, Jesus says a very interesting thing about his disciples. "I confer on you a kingdom," he says, "just as my Father conferred one on me, so that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel." See, it's no coincidence that Jesus chose 12 disciples. The 12 disciples were a quite deliberate echo on Jesus' part of the 12 tribes of Israel. For they were the kind of nucleus of the new Israel, the new 12 tribes that he was going to constitute to occupy the new land, the kingdom of heaven, which he was going to give to them. And here, as I say, right on the eve of his crucifixion, we find an ugly surfacing of exactly the same kind of selfishness which we see in the book of Joshua among the original 12 tribes. Who's going to be the greatest? Once again, you notice that like Joshua the first, Joshua the second, Jesus, will not concede to this kind of selfish individualism. See what he says to them. The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them. This is a pagan way of thinking, in other words. And those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors. But you are not to be like that. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest. And the one who rules, like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who is at the table? But I am among you as one who serves. I can't help but feel that he's alluding there to an incident Luke doesn't record, but John does, of how Jesus at this same table had washed his disciples' feet. The action of a menial, the action of a servant. I am among you as one who serves. Pagans, then, may play the power game. Pagans may engage in rivalry, trying to steal the glory from others, making life into a competition. Who can be the biggest? Who can be the greatest? Who can have the most? That is not to be the way you, my people, think if you want to tread the path to heaven. Heaven is not going to be paradise for people like that. Be content with what you have. Be content with the material things you've got. Be content, more than that, with the spiritual role you are given in the kingdom of God. Don't be forever trying to edge your way into more than God has really called you to occupy. Relationships within the people of God, of course, always get soured when this kind of argument breaks out, when people try to steal a bigger slice of the action for themselves, when people try to occupy more space than really belongs to them. Beware of greed, then. Not just materialistic greed. Beware of the kind of greed that actually operates within the circle of Christian service within the life of the church itself. It's a very important lesson, isn't it, for anyone who wants to aspire to leadership, particularly. I meet quite a lot of young men who want to be preachers and pastors and come and ask my advice about it. One of the things maybe this lesson from the book of Joshua we're learning tonight might mean for them is this. Are you really using the opportunities you've got? Are you really witnessing to your friends? Are you really serving your church in humble tasks? Are you really even doing the daily work God has given you to do in a faithful way, making the most of the opportunity God has given you to be his servant? In that connection, just look at an interesting verse in Colossians chapter 3. Thinking about daily work, something which, of course, some of us here will have to commence shortly. This may be a worthwhile text to have in mind. It's directed at slaves. Colossians 3, verse 22. An order of society that mercifully we don't have today, but one which was very numerous in the days of the New Testament. Just notice the way that the New Testament apostles exhort slaves to respond to their slave status. Colossians 3, 22. Slaves, obey your earthly masters in everything. And do it not only when their eye is on you and to win their favour, but with sincerity of heart and reverence for the Lord. Now, this is a bit I want you to notice. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for men. Why? Since you know that you will receive an inheritance. There's that word again. An inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It is the Lord Christ you are serving. Do you see how the New Testament applies this Old Testament principle of the promised inheritance to us Christians? We have an inheritance, a heavenly inheritance, and living in the light of that future hope, that inheritance, puts an altogether different gloss on the indignities, even, that we may suffer in this world in our daily work. We may even be slaves. Well, we shall be hard-working, conscientious slaves, if so. Lifted above the humiliation of our status by the knowledge that we belong to the Lord Christ. We are serving Him. And we look forward to the inheritance which He will give us as our ultimate reward. For you see, we're going home. We are going home. We are on a journey. The world in general may be still feels lost, but if we are Christians, we have suddenly found our feet placed on that road that leads home. It's a wonderful feeling. At last you know where you're going. At last you know you have a destination. At last you know you even have a destiny. You're going home. Jesus has already opened the door of that home for us. The welcoming mat is there to greet us. But our study tonight reminds us that the journey to that home is not to be expected to be a bed of roses. The great theologian Augustine said, "It is one thing to view the land of peace from the woody ridge. It is another thing to tread the path that leads it." Certainly is. There are victories we must win before we will reach that homeland of ours. Victories over sin in our lives. Victories over materialistic greed. Victories over pride and selfish ambition. These perils lurk on our way to trip us up. If we yield to them completely, they may even turn us from the path altogether. You've surely read Pilgrim's Progress and know how Bunyan allegorizes that very point in that great book. That's why, of course, the New Testament so often likens the Christian life to a battle. The battle belongs to the Lord. In heavenly armor, we'll conquer the land. These are Christian metaphors that drawn, you see, from this typology of our Old Testament study tonight. Perhaps, therefore, more than any other quality, we need perseverance for the journey. Maybe that's the greatest lesson of this section of Joshua altogether. Remember how it begins? You're getting very old, Joshua. And there's a sort of implication that as you've got older, Joshua, your energy and your enthusiasm for the battle has faded a bit. There is always the risk, you see, as the years go by, whatever our early enthusiasm at the start of the journey may be, that we may begin to compromise with the enemy. Career and family, the cynicism of midlife, these things sap our commitment to the battle. In that connection, there is one person who stands out marvelously in these chapters, as an exemplar of spiritual vigor right to the end of the journey. Caleb. That's why we read his story right at the beginning. Remember in chapter 14, verse 6? Caleb, together with Joshua, was one of the only people who came back 45 years earlier than this with a report from the promised land. Yes, we can take it.
We can take this land in spite of the fact that there are giants in the land and they're heavily fortified cities. The Lord being our helper, we can take it. Only Caleb the son of Jephunneh and only Joshua the son of Nun, of the spies that went into the promised land 2 years after the Israelites left Egypt, only those two men brought back such an optimistic, such a confident report. All the others discouraged the Israelites. We can never do it. They're far too powerful. And that, of course, is why they spent the next 38 years wandering in the wilderness. But do you know the really encouraging thing? Through all those 38 years of wandering in the wilderness, Caleb's spiritual vigor, the resilience of his faith, it never waned. There aren't many people, you know, of whom you can say that. Many years ago, I was the president of a Christian union in Nottingham University. And for some while after I went down, I kept tabs on the other members, or as many of them as I could keep tabs on, from my year in that Christian union. Do you know, I have to say, within 5 or 10 years, far too many of them had lost their spiritual edge. Oh, there were some glorious exceptions. We had some Calebs too, I'm glad to say. But far too many of them decayed in their spiritual commitment after they went down from university. Like I say, sometimes it was career ambition, sometimes it was family responsibility, sometimes the excuse was, we couldn't find a good church. Sometimes I think it was just getting older. The idealism of youth turning into the disillusionment of midlife, like I said just now. Far too many of them went into the wilderness and never came out again. Like the Jews, perhaps, who fell in the wilderness, I worry that some of them, maybe, never made it to the promised land. Don't let that happen to you, will you? Perseverance. That's perhaps the quality we need most of all. And Caleb is the man to show it to us. See what he says here in chapter 14? I'm 85 now, Joshua, but I'm still ready for the fight. When I was 40, I told you we could take that hill country. Well, now I'm 85. I've got the opportunity to do it. Please let me. What a man, eh? Good to meet elderly saints with that kind of vision and enthusiasm for the future. People sometimes ask me, which Christian has exercised the most influence on you, Roy? You know, who's had the most influence on you as a Christian? And I'm sure they're expecting me to say somebody like John Stott or Martin Lloyd-Jones or, you know, somebody of that ilk. Well, when I think about it, it's a very difficult question to answer, of course, honestly, but, you know, when I think about it, the nearest I can come up with for an answer is Ada Webb. Ada Webb was an elderly lady. In fact, the uncharitable would have called her an old maid, for she was a single old lady. She taught the Bible class in the first church I ever joined. And I joined that Bible class for a year or so. I learned more from her, I think, at a critical stage in my Christian life, than I have learned from anybody since. For elderly though she was, like Caleb, she still had an appetite for conquering mountains. She never stopped growing, you see. She never stopped aspiring for holiness. She never stopped believing that people she knew could become Christians if she witnessed to them. She never lost her passion for the Bible. She was a great example. Next challenge, to never rest on your laurels. Caleb's a great example. of a Christian, of a believer who goes on to the very end of their life believing in the promises, and because they believe in the promises, living actively the life of faith. Against the laziness and the greed that we see exemplified among some of the other members of these 12 tribes, Caleb exemplifies the courageous vigor and the godly opportunism that God really wants to see in us if we're going to be men and women of faith. You remember what the writer of the Hebrews says about people like that? He says, God is not ashamed to be called their God. It's a weird thing to say, isn't it? God is not ashamed to be called their God. I mean, isn't it a rather odd thought to think that God could be ashamed of anything? But yes, it seems sometimes there are people among his people he is ashamed of. He is ashamed to be called their God, but Caleb was not one of those. Now, people of faith like Caleb are people of whom God would say, I'm proud of them. I'm not ashamed to be called their God. And if you want to have an ambition, why not make it your ambition that at the age of 85, God will say that about you? And let's pray together.